This is Audible.
Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Daniken. Narrated by William DeFreeze. Copyright 1968 by Eric von Daniken. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with John W. White Literary Agency and was produced in the year 2011 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Keep listening after Chariots of the Gods for a bonus interview with author Eric von Daniken. Foreword. It was more than a quarter of a century ago, in February 1968, that my first book, Memories of the Future, was published by Aecon, a German publisher. I had written the book 2 years earlier, but rejection letters from publishers fluttered on my desk with great regularity. Sorry, not usable for our program. We are very sorry. We don't want to go this way. We recommend a more esoteric publisher. In later years, I was often asked how this publishing miracle happened, to finally place this controversial work with a renowned textbook house. Today, I can finally confess, with outside help and a little discretion. I met Dr. Thomas von Randau, then the science editor of the weekly Die Zeit, in the summer of 1967. He leafed through the neatly typed manuscript, examined some of the peculiar pictures, and decided, "This is not for us. You have to publish it as a book." "And how does one find a publisher?" Dr. von Randau puffed on his pipe, looked me straight in the eyes. "I do know a publisher. I could just give him a noncommittal call if you wish." He picked up the telephone and asked to be connected with Dr. Erwin Barth von Werenalp, the chief of Aecon Publishing. The blood rushed to my head. After all, I knew what Dr. von Randau could not know. My manuscript had already been turned down by Aecon. Naturally, the ensuing conversation stuck in my gray brain cells. "I have in front of me a young Swiss who wrote a totally mad book. But the guy is not mad. Maybe you should listen to him yourself." The person on the other end of the line wanted to know if I could come to his office promptly. Could I? I told myself that the boss of a large publishing house could not know what his junior staff had earlier decided about my manuscript. The deal was closed after lunch with a young editor. The manuscript would have to be slightly reworked and would be published in the spring of 1968. We only had a conflict about one point. "Memories of the Future is an impossible title. One can't remember the future," the editor argued. But I remained stubborn and refused any change of title. In 1969, it was renamed Chariots of the Gods by my British publisher, Souvenir Press, and has since become world-famous by that title, so I shall use it from here on. What Chariots of the Gods meant to me was described in an introduction that is also part of this edition. The book caused an avalanche. 2 years after its publication, 30 printings totaling 600,000 copies had been issued. In 1969, a film with the same title was released, which reached American television in 1970. That created a new virus, Danekenitis, time. The theme became a worldwide topic of conversation. Did our forebears receive a visit from the universe? By the time the book had been on the market for 3 years, it had been sold in 28 languages and was published in 36 countries. With the success came the critique. Professor Ernst von Koen collected articles by 17 scientists in the book Were the Gods Astronauts? Some of the articles were strongly critical, some favorable. Since that day, counterbooks sprouted from the ground on all continents, as if a warm rain had fallen. Some swamp flowers were among them. I was accused of plagiarism and unscientific ideas, also anti-religious bias and ignorance of scientifically established facts. What has remained after all these years? Have I really spread nonsense? I wrote about the maps of the Turkish admiral Piri Reis, which can still be admired in the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul. The coasts of both North and South America are drawn with precision. This statement was wrong. Actually, the contours of North and South America are only faintly visible. This accepted correction does not distract from the sensational character of the Piri Reis map, because this map also shows exactly the coastal lines of Antarctica, which today are still buried under eternal ice. I did write then that the Upper Egyptian Isle, Elephantine, got its name because, seen from the air, it shows the form of an elephant. This information was completely wrong. Or I speculated that the sun door, which is mentioned in the Gilgamesh epic, could be identical to the sun door of Tiahuanaco in the highlands of Bolivia. Total poppycock. The gate of the sun at Tiahuanaco got its name only during the last century. What it was thousands of years ago, nobody knows. I also wrote, "What a miracle is the five-strand fantastic necklace of green jade in the burial pyramid of Tikal in Guatemala. A miracle because the jade comes from China." It was a false miracle that I transmitted. The jade came from Central America. With regard to the future, I wrote, "The Mars timetable is here. The Mars spaceship is constructed. It only needs to be built." The statement, written in 1966, was then correct. The Mars timetable, however, was thrown out by NASA for financial or other reasons. It is the right of all beginners to be so free, trusting, and not so self-critical as their elders. Often my enthusiasm got the better of me, or I accepted second-hand information. And then again I trusted the information of a science writer only to be told later that the view of this clever man had been refuted a long time ago. I was promptly hung by those of contrary opinion as refuted. But these refutations amounted to no more than contrary opinion. It got even worse when some theses that I had never said or written were refuted. These true and admitted errors in Chariots of the Gods were unable to destroy either the basic theory or derived ideas. Here I hear a contradiction. This von Daniken was really disproved long ago. Here are some examples. Dr. Johannes Fibag, the natural scientist, has collected them, and they were published in the German magazine Ancient Skies, number 6, 1991. Published by the Ancient Astronaut Society, post fac, ch-3803, Beatenburg, Switzerland. See page Roman numeral 16 for the address of the American edition. Let's take as an example the German professor Herbert Willemy. Willemy studied geography, geology, political economy, and ethnology, and has been a professor in Kiel, Stuttgart, and Tübingen. His world renown as a scientist is certainly well-founded, and his book, The World of the Maya, is counted among the standard works of Mayan studies. But let's look a little closer at Chapter 8 in his book, Foreign Influences on the Maya Civilization, Speculations about Earlier Seafarers and Astronauts. Willemy writes, "Von Daniken's astronaut gods came more than 10,000 years ago in giant spaceships from the universe." And Erich von Daniken connected, with their landing on Earth, the peninsula of Yucatan in two places in his book, Palenque and La Venta. With this sentence alone, the grave mistake in Willemy's work becomes clear. In 1981 he quotes only Chariots of the Gods and Return to the Stars, published in the U.S. as Gods from Outer Space, published in 1968 and 1969. Even in his second revised edition of 1989, Willemy did not change anything. Later works by me and other authors passed him by without a trace, especially my Maya book published in 1984, The Day the Gods Came. In no other field of science could one cite 21-year-old works and ignore later publications by the same author. Willemy commits a second error in his claim of exclusive truth for his point of view. He critically takes apart, piece by piece, my description of a worked-over monolith in La Venta. I had written, there stands a carefully worked monolith, on which a snake, or rather a dragon, is featured. A man sits inside the animal. The soles of his feet push pedals. The left hand rests on a switchgear. The head is covered by a tightly fitting helmet. On his lips rests an instrument which can be identified as a microphone. Villamy comments, Von Daniken's pictorial reproduction has unfortunately some technical flaws, and does not, in comparison to the original at Villa Hermosa, permit realization that it is not a dragon, but an enormous snake which guards a sarcophagus or a burial chamber with a crouching body. Actually, some of the attributes, such as the rattle on its tail, do point to an enormous snake, but does this unambiguously indicate presentation of a corpse? Are there also, in scientific publications, technical printing faults, which led other archaeologists to recognize in that figure the well-known god Kukulcan? They do not consider him dead and in a burial chamber, but alive. He waves an aspergillum. An aspergill or aspergillum is a brush used to scatter holy water. Newspapers readily accept the welcome retort in spite of this openly visible error in argumentation. Hans Schoenfeld wrote, for instance, in the Berliner Zeitung, December 13, 1989, "Now it goes with full force against the science fiction author," meaning me. "He starts with his proofs that the extraterrestrial spaceship Voyager visited our Earth more than 10,000 years ago, but the dragon monolith described by him is just 2,000 to 3,000 years old." Erich von Däniken's correction, where did I date the Leventa monolith as 10,000 years old, was never published by the paper. Self-corrections are obviously made neither here, Villamy, nor there, Berliner Zeitung. This is further reinforced in another case which is offered by Villamy to his readers, Palenque. The tombstone of Palenque has often been cited and interpreted in many ways. Villamy, however, presents his own version, pertaining to the corn deity Yumcax, as the proven interpretation. He claims that I manipulate my readers suggestively, since I look at the tombstone from the wrong side, namely, that is, the broadside. The position of the plate in the small burial chamber and the total combination of the relief do not allow any doubt that the narrow side was the viewer's side. Only from that view does the presentation of the relief make sense. If it were not meant so seriously, one would have to break into Homeric laughter. By the time of the start of the manned spacecraft, even Villamy would have to have realized that the viewing angle of the relief presentation propagandized by him looks even more like an astronaut flying through the universe. So who manipulates whom? A last point should be mentioned here to show us how an established scientist can be critical toward others, however uncritical toward himself. Villamy writes, "Just an example of Erich von Däniken's lack of literary knowledge. He talks of the sacred cenote in Chichen Itza, and of the second not-too-distant one from which the inhabitants of the ceremonial center collected their utility water. They resemble each other strikingly, even on the height of the water level. Without any question, both are wells of the same age, and probably owe their existence to the impact of meteorites. The mysterious veil which is spread over the long-established fact is a crack-brained invention by von Däniken. The cenotes are not caused by meteor impacts, but by a breakthrough of the tops of karst caverns, which are widely spread through northern Yucatan. The creation of cenotes has been known since 1910. All the important surveys of the Mayan civilization list these in an unambiguously scientific way." Only one thing seems clear. Even renowned scientists err badly, however vociferously they proclaim these statements. The cenote denial of Villamy shows this in a dramatic fashion. What is it all about? 66 million years ago, at the turn between the Cretaceous and the Tertiary periods, the dinosaurs, and with them 3/4 of the known fauna, became extinct. The end came suddenly. The majority of the geologists concerned with this problem assume today that the impact of enormous meteorites so deeply harmed the environment, soot particles in the air, drop of temperature, vaporized rocks causing acid rain, etc., for thousands of years, that it resulted in extinction of the fauna. What was missing for a long time was the discovery of the possible sites of the enormous meteorites. Since early 1991, this seems to have been discovered. Where? In the Yucatan. Geologists have even before that time discovered huge deposits of rubble and melted rocks in the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary sediment in the Caribbean. One could therefore conclude that the corresponding crater could not be far away. One must therefore presume that it would be on the bottom of the ocean, or south of Cuba. But then the NASA satellite photo of 1987 brought home this sensation. Through them, it has been possible to reconstruct the water supply system of the Maya and to reveal a half circle of about 200 kilometers of cenotes, karst holes or dolinas. Today, geologists are certain that this ring, including the cenotes of Chichen Itza, formed the rim of the gigantic impact structure. Only one thing seems clearly known. The water can circulate much better in the rocks, lying below and totally crushed, which leads to dissolution of the limestone above, which was created only after the impact and the cenotes were created. The Sheikh Salub crater, named after the little village near Merida in the center of the structure, is now considered the number one candidate in the search for the cause of the extinction of the Saurians. In contrast to the suggestions by Villamy, my writing is totally correct. He only writes, "It is possible that we owe their existence to the impact of the meteorites, and not that they are." A polymath like Villamy could, of course, not have anticipated what the cenotes would turn out to be, but this example shows in truly classical manner how quickly so-called truth proved to be an error, while speculative assumptions, even by non-scientists, can prove to be close to the truth. Such is the interpolation of Dr. Johannes Fiebach. Am I embittered and worn down by the overdrawn and mendacious critics of the last quarter century? In no way. I learned a great deal from criticism. Often it was correct and put some ideas into reasonable relationships. Besides, it was not only criticism that pelted me. Books were published by scientific sources, Prodonican books, and numerous articles in many languages. My archives are full of them. Too bad that some media sources remained stuck in their prejudices. It is also so sad that many scientists, authors, and copywriters gathered honey from my books without honestly listing the source. I have personally written, since Chariots of the Gods, 20 more books, all of which are concerned with the same themes. The untroubled interest by readers in Gods from Outer Space caused every one of my successive titles to appear on the bestseller list of Germany's Der Spiegel. The Ancient Astronaut Society, AAS, was founded in the United States in 1973 by Chicago attorney Gene M. Phillips as a nonprofit organization to deal with my themes. For information, write to Ancient Astronaut Society, 1921 St. John's Avenue, Highland Park, Illinois, 60035-3105. There are now 10,000 members worldwide. Dr. Luis Nevilla of the New York Institute of Technology writes, "If you examine the hypothesis with an unprejudiced and open attitude, you will soon find that nothing in this hypothesis contravenes the strictest rules of science and our present understanding of the universe. The great merit of Erich von Däniken consists in his bringing to attention innumerable archaeological, cultural, historical, and religious phenomena, which suddenly make sense if one takes into consideration the possibility of extraterrestrial visitors. And this is exactly what one expects from a reasonable and plausible hypothesis." Bearing precisely on that matter, the Sanskrit scholar Dr. Dilip Kumar Kanjilal, professor of Sanskrit and Indology at the Sanskrit College of Calcutta, brought this observation forward. "It can be doubtlessly proven from old Indic texts that the earth had been visited and influenced by extraterrestrials in remotest antiquity." So it stands. Erich von Däniken, Beatenburg, Switzerland, June 1995. Introduction. It took courage to write this book, and it will take courage to read it. Because its theories and proofs do not fit into the mosaic of traditional archaeology, constructed so laboriously and firmly cemented down, scholars will call it nonsense and put it on the index of those books which are better left unmentioned. Laymen will withdraw into the snail shell of their familiar world when faced with the probability that finding out about our past will be even more mysterious and adventurous than finding out about the future. Nevertheless, one thing is certain. There is something inconsistent about our past, that past that lies thousands and millions of years behind us. The past teemed with unknown gods who visited the primeval Earth and manned spaceships. Incredible technical achievements existed in the past. There is a mass of know-how that we have only partially rediscovered today. There is something inconsistent about our archaeology. Because we find electric batteries many thousands of years old, because we find strange beings in perfect spacesuits with platinum fasteners, because we find numbers with 15 digits, something not registered by any computer. But how did these early men acquire the ability to create them? There is something inconsistent about our religion. A feature common to every religion is that it promises help and salvation to mankind. The primitive gods gave such promises too. Why didn't they keep them? Why did they use ultra-modern weapons on primitive peoples? And why did they plan to destroy them? Let us get used to the idea that the world of ideas that has grown up over the millennia is going to collapse. A few years of accurate research has already brought down the mental edifice in which we had made ourselves at home. Knowledge that was hidden in the libraries of secret societies is being rediscovered. The age of space travel is no longer an age of secrets. We have now landed on the moon. Space travel, which aspires to suns and stars, also plumbs the abysses of our past for us. Gods and priests, kings and heroes, emerge from the dark chasms. We must challenge them to deliver up their secrets, for we have the means to find out all about our past without leaving any gaps, if we really want to. Modern laboratories must take over the work of archaeological research. Archaeologists must visit the devastated sites of the past with ultra-sensitive measuring apparatus. Priests who seek the truth must again begin to doubt everything that is established. The gods of the dim past have left countless traces that we can read and decipher today for the first time, because the problem of space travel, so topical today, was not a problem but a reality to the men of thousands of years ago. I claim that our forefathers received visits from the universe in the remote past, even though I do not yet know who these extraterrestrial intelligences were or from which planet they came. I nevertheless proclaim that these strangers annihilated part of mankind existing at the time and produced a new, perhaps the first, Homo sapiens. This assertion is revolutionary. It shatters the base on which a mental edifice that seemed to be so perfect was constructed. It is my aim to try to provide proof of this assertion. My book would not have been written without the encouragement and collaboration of many people. I should like to thank my wife, who has seen little of me at home during the last few years, for her understanding. I should like to thank my friend, Hans Neuner, my traveling companion for many thousands of miles, for his unfailing and valuable help. I should like to thank Dr. Stalin and Lewis Emmerich for their continuous support. I should like to thank all the NASA personnel at Houston, Cape Kennedy, and Huntsville who showed me around their magnificent scientific and technical research centers. I should like to thank Werner von Braun, Willy Ley, and Bert Slattery. I should like to thank all the countless men and women around the globe whose practical help, encouragement, and conversation made this book possible. Erich von Däniken. Chapter 1. Are there intelligent beings in the cosmos? Is it conceivable that we world citizens of the 20th century are not the only living beings of our kind in the cosmos. Because no homunculus from another planet is on display in a museum for us to visit, the answer, "Our Earth is the only planet with human beings," still seems to be legitimate and convincing. But the forest of question marks grows and grows as soon as we make a careful study of the facts resulting from the latest discoveries and research work. On a clear night, the naked eye can see about 4,500 stars. So the astronomers say. The telescope of even a small observatory makes nearly 2 million stars visible. And a modern reflecting telescope brings the light from thousands of millions more to the viewer. Specks of light in the Milky Way. But in the colossal dimensions of the cosmos, our stellar system is only a tiny part of an incomparably larger stellar system, of a cluster of Milky Ways, one might say, containing some 20 galaxies within a radius of 1,500,000 light-years. 1 light-year equals the distance traveled by light in a year. That is, 186,000 times 60 times 60 times 24 times 365 miles. And even this vast number of stars is small in comparison with the many thousands of spiral nebulae disclosed by the electronic telescope. Disclosed to the present day, I should emphasize, for research of this kind is only just beginning. Astronomer Harlow Shapley estimates that there are some 10 to the 20th power stars within the range of our telescopes. When Shapley associates a planetary system with only 1 in 1,000 stars, we may assume that it is a very cautious estimate. If we continue to speculate on the basis of this estimate and suspect the necessary conditions for life on only 1 star in 1,000, this calculation still gives a figure of 10 to the 14th power. Shapley asks, how many stars in this truly astronomical figure have an atmosphere suitable for life? 1 in 1,000? That would still leave the incredible figure of 10 to the 11th power stars with the prerequisites for life. Even if we assume that only every 1,000th planet out of this figure has produced life, there are still 100 million planets on which we can speculate that life exists. This calculation is based on telescopes using the techniques available today, but we must not forget that these are constantly being improved. If we follow the hypothesis of biochemist Dr. Stanley Miller, life and the conditions essential for life may have developed more quickly on some of these planets than on Earth. If we accept this daring assumption, civilizations more advanced than our own could have developed on 100,000 planets. The late Willy Ley, well-known scientific writer and friend of Wernher von Braun, told me in New York, "The estimated number of stars in our Milky Way alone amounts to 30 billion. The assumption that our Milky Way contains at least 16 billion planetary systems is considered admissible by present-day astronomers. If we now try to reduce the figures in question as much as possible and assume that the distances between planetary systems are so regulated that only in 1 case in 100 does a planet orbit in the ecosphere of its own sun, that still leaves 180 million planets capable of supporting life. If we further assume that only 1 planet in 100 that might support life actually does so, we should still have the figure of 1.8 million planets with life. Let us further suppose that out of every 100 planets with life, there is one on which creatures with the same level of intelligence as Homo sapiens live. Then even this last supposition gives our Milky Way the vast number of 18,000 inhabited planets. Since the latest counts give 100 billion fixed stars in our Milky Way, probability indicates an incomparably higher figure than Dr. Ley puts forward in his cautious calculation. Without quoting fantastic figures or taking unknown galaxies into account, we may surmise that there are 18,000 planets comparatively close to the Earth with conditions essential to life similar to those of our own planet. Yet we can go even further and speculate that if only 1% of these 18,000 planets were actually inhabited, there would still be 180 left. There is no doubt about the existence of planets similar to the Earth, with a similar mixture of atmospheric gases, similar gravity, similar flora, and possibly even similar fauna. But is it even essential for the planets that support life to have conditions similar to the Earth's? The idea that life can flourish only under terrestrial conditions has been made obsolete by research. It is a mistake to believe that life cannot exist without water and oxygen. Even on our own Earth, there are forms of life that need no oxygen. They are called anaerobic bacteria. A given amount of oxygen acts like poison on them. Why should there not be higher forms of life that do not need oxygen? Under the pressure of the new knowledge that is being acquired every day, we shall have to bring our mental world picture up to date. Scientific investigation, concentrated on our Earth until very recently, has praised this world of ours as the ideal planet. It is not too hot and not too cold. It has plenty of water. There are unlimited quantities of oxygen. Organic processes constantly rejuvenate nature. In fact, the assumption that life can exist and develop only on a planet like the Earth is untenable. It is estimated that 2 million different species of living creatures live on the Earth. Of these, this again is an estimate, 1,200,000 are known scientifically. And among these forms of life known to science, there are still a few thousand that ought not to be able to live at all according to current ideas. The premises for life must be thought out and tested anew. For example, one would think that highly radioactive water would be free from germs. But there are actually some kinds of bacteria which can adapt themselves to the lethal water that surrounds nuclear reactors. An experiment carried out by biologist Dr. Sanford Siegel sounds eerie. He recreated the atmospheric conditions of Jupiter in his laboratory and bred bacteria and mites in this atmosphere, which share none of the prerequisites we have hitherto laid down for life. Ammonia, methane, and hydrogen did not kill them. The experiments by Dr. Howard Hinton and Dr. Bloom, Bristol University entomologists, had equally startling results. The two scientists dried a species of midge for several hours at a temperature of 100 degrees centigrade. Immediately afterward, they immersed their guinea pigs in liquid helium, which, as is well known, is as cold as space. After heavy irradiation, they returned the midges to their normal living conditions. The insects continued their biological vital functions and produced perfectly healthy midges. We also know of bacteria that live in volcanoes, of others that eat stone, and some that produce iron. The forest of question marks grows. Experiments are going on at many research centers. New proofs that life is by no means bound to the prerequisites for life on our planet are constantly accumulating. For centuries, the world appeared to revolve around the laws and conditions that govern life on Earth. This conviction distorted and blurred our way of looking at things. It put blinkers on scientific investigators, who unhesitatingly accepted our standards and systems of thought when viewing the universe. Teilhard de Chardin, the epoch-making thinker, suggested that only the fantastic has a chance of being real in the cosmos. If our way of thinking worked the other way around, it would mean that intelligences on another planet took their living conditions as a criterion. If they lived at temperatures of minus 150 to 200 degrees centigrade, they would think that those temperatures, which are destructive to life as we know it, were essential for life on other planets. That would match up to the logic with which we are trying to illuminate the darkness of our past. We owe it to our self-respect to be rational and objective. At some time or other, every daring theory seemed to be a utopia. How many utopias have long since become everyday realities? Of course, the examples given here are meant to point out the most far-fetched possibilities, yet once the improbable things that we cannot even conceive of today are shown to be true, as they will be, barriers will fall, allowing free access to the impossibilities the cosmos still conceals. Future generations will find all kinds of life that have never been dreamed of in the universe. Even if we are not there to see it, they will have to accept the fact that they are not the only and certainly not the oldest intelligences in the cosmos. The universe is estimated to be between 8 and 12 billion years old. Meteorites bring traces of organic matter under our microscopes. Bacteria millions of years old awake to new life. Floating spores traverse the universe, and at some time or other are captured by the gravitational field of a planet. New life has gone on developing in the perpetual cycle of creation for millions of years. Innumerable careful examinations of all kinds of stones in all parts of the world prove that the Earth's crust was formed about 4 billion years ago. Yes, and all that science knows is that something like man existed 1 million years ago. And out of that gigantic river of time, it has managed to dam up only a tiny rivulet of 7,000 years of human history, at the cost of a lot of hard work, many adventures, and a great deal of curiosity. But what are 7,000 years of human history compared with thousands of millions of years of the history of the universe? We, the paragons of creation, took 400,000 years to reach our present state and our present stature. Who can produce concrete proof to show why another planet should not have provided more favorable conditions for the development of other or similar intelligences? Is there any reason why we may not have competitors on another planet who are equal or superior to us? Are we entitled to discard this possibility? We have done so up to the present. How often the pillars of our wisdom have crumbled into dust. Hundreds and hundreds of generations thought that the earth was flat. The iron law that the sun went around the earth held good for thousands of years. We are still convinced that our earth is the center of everything, although it has been proved that the earth is an ordinary planet of insignificant size, 30,000 light-years from the center of the Milky Way. The time has come for us to admit our insignificance by making discoveries in the infinite unexplored cosmos. Only then shall we realize that we are nothing but ants in the vast state of the universe. And yet our future and our opportunities lie in the universe, where the gods promised they would. Not until we have taken a look into the future shall we be strong and bold enough to investigate our past honestly and impartially. Chapter 2. When Our Spaceship Landed on Earth. Jules Verne, the grandfather of all science fiction novelists, has become an accepted writer. His fantasies are no longer science fiction, and the astronauts of our day travel around the world in 86 minutes, not 80 days. We are now going to describe what might happen on an imaginary journey by spaceship. Yet this imaginary journey will become possible in fewer decades than the time it took to contract Jules Verne's crazy notion of a journey around the world in 80 days to a lightning journey of 86 minutes. But let us not think in terms of such short periods of time. Let us assume that our spaceship will leave the Earth for an unknown distant sun in 150 years' time. The spaceship would be as big as a present-day ocean liner, and would therefore have a launching weight of about 100,000 tons, with a fuel load of 99,800 tons, that is, an effective payload of 200 tons. Impossible? Already we could assemble a spaceship piece by piece while in orbit around a planet. Yet even this assembly work will become unnecessary in less than two decades, because it will be possible to prepare the giant spaceship for launching on the moon. Besides, the basic research for the rocket propulsion of tomorrow is in full swing. Future rocket motors will mainly be powered by nuclear fusion and travel at nearly the speed of light. A bold new method, the feasibility of which has already been shown by physical experiments on individual elementary particles, will be the photon rocket. The fuel carried on board the photon rocket enables the rocket's velocity to approach so close to the speed of light that the effects of relativity, especially the variation in time between the launching site and spaceship, can operate to the full. The fuel supplies will be transformed into electromagnetic radiation and ejected as a clustered propulsive jet with the speed of light. Theoretically, a spaceship equipped with photon propulsion can reach 99% of the speed of light. At this speed, the boundaries of our solar system would be blasted open. an idea that really makes the mind reel. But we, who are on the threshold of a new age, should remember that the giant strides in technology which our grandfathers experienced were just as staggering in their day. The railways, electricity, telegraphy, the first car, the first airplane. We ourselves heard music in the air for the first time. We see color TV. We saw the first launching of spaceships and American astronauts actually walking on the moon. And we get news and pictures from satellites that revolve around the Earth. Our children's children will go on interstellar journeys and carry out cosmic research in the universities. Let us follow the journey of our imaginary spaceship, whose goal is a distant fixed star. It would certainly be amusing to try to imagine what the crew of the spaceship did to kill time on their journey, because however vast the distances they covered, and however slowly time might crawl along for those left behind on Earth, Einstein's theory of relativity still holds good. It may sound incredible, but time on board the spaceship, traveling barely below the speed of light, actually passes more slowly than on the Earth. For example, only 10 years pass for our crew on their flight in the universe, whereas 108 years go by for those who stay at home. This shift in time between the space travelers and the people on Earth can be calculated by the basic rocket equation worked out by Professor Ackerett. At the moment, when our spaceship is approaching the star which is its target, the crew will undoubtedly examine planets, fix their position, undertake spectral analyses, measure forces of gravity, and calculate orbits. Lastly, they will choose as a landing place the planet whose conditions come closest to those of our Earth. If our spaceship consists solely of its payload after a journey of, shall we say, 80 light years, because all the energy supplies have been used up, the crew will have to replenish the tanks of their spacecraft with fissionable material at their goal. Let us assume, then, that the planet chosen to land on is similar to the Earth. I have already said that this assumption is by no means impossible. Let us also venture the supposition that the civilization of the planet visited is in about the same state of development as the Earth was 8,000 years ago. Of course, this would all have been confirmed by the instruments on board the spaceship long before the landing. Naturally, our space travelers have also picked on a landing site that lies close to a supply of fissionable matter. Their instruments show quickly and reliably in which mountain ranges uranium can be found. The landing is carried out according to plan. Our space travelers see beings making stone tools. They see them hunting and killing game by throwing spears. Flocks of sheep and goats are grazing on the steppe. Primitive potters are making simple household utensils. A strange sight to greet our astronauts. But what do the primitive beings on this planet think about the monstrosity that has just landed there, and the figures that climbed out of it? Let us not forget that we too were semi-savages 8,000 years ago. So it is not surprising when the semi-savages who experienced this event bury their faces in the ground and dare not raise their eyes. Until this day, they have worshipped the sun and the moon, and now something earth-shaking has happened. The gods have come down from heaven. From a safe hiding place, the inhabitants of the planet watch our space travelers, who wear strange hats with rods on their heads, helmets with antennae. They are amazed when the night is made bright as day. Searchlights. They are terrified when the strangers rise effortlessly into the air. Rocket belts. They bury their heads in the ground again when weird unknown animals soar in the air, droning, buzzing, and snorting. Helicopters, all-purpose vehicles. And lastly, they take flight to the safe refuge of their caves when a frightening boom and rumble resounds from the mountains. A trial explosion. Undoubtedly, our astronauts must seem like almighty gods to these primitive people. Day by day, the space travelers continue their laborious work, and after some time, a delegation of priests or medicine men will probably approach the astronauts in order to make contact with the gods. They bring gifts to pay homage to their guests. It is conceivable that our spacemen will rapidly learn the language of the inhabitants with the help of a computer, and can thank them for the courtesy shown. Yet although they can explain to the savages in their own language that no gods have landed, that no higher beings worthy of adoration have paid a visit, it has no effect. Our primitive friends simply do not believe it. The space travelers came from other stars. They obviously have tremendous power and the ability to perform miracles. They must be gods. There is also no point in the spacemen's trying to explain any help they may offer. It is all far beyond the comprehension of these people who have been so terrifyingly invaded. Although it is impossible to imagine all the things that might take place from the day of landing onward, the following points might well figure on a preconceived plan. Part of the population would be won over and trained to help search a crater formed by an explosion for fissionable matter needed for the return to Earth. The most intelligent of the inhabitants would be elected king. As a visible sign of his power, he would be given a radio set through which he could contact and address the gods at any time. Our astronauts would try to teach the natives the simplest forms of civilization and some moral concepts in order to make the development of a social order possible. A few specially selected women would be fertilized by the astronauts. Thus, a new race would arise that skipped a stage in natural evolution. We know from our own development how long it would take before this new race became space experts. Consequently, before the astronauts began their return flight to Earth, they would leave behind clear and visible signs which only a highly technical, mathematically based society would be able to understand much, much later. Any attempt to warn our protégés of dangers in store would have little chance of success. Even if we show them the most horrifying films of terrestrial wars and atomic explosions, it would not prevent the beings living on this planet from committing the same follies any more than it now stops, almost, the whole of sentient humanity from constantly playing with the burning flame of war. While our spaceship disappears again into the mists of the universe, our friends will talk about the miracle. The gods were here. They will translate it into their simple language and turn it into a saga to be handed down to their sons and daughters. They will turn the presents and implements and everything that the space travelers left behind into holy relics. If our friends have mastered writing, they may make a record of what happened. Uncanny, weird, miraculous. Then their texts will relate, and drawings will show, that gods in golden clothes were there in a flying boat that landed with a tremendous din. They will write about chariots which the gods drove over land and sea, and of terrifying weapons that were like lightning, and they will recount that the gods promised to return. They will hammer and chisel in the rock pictures of what they had once seen, shapeless giants with helmets and rods on their heads, carrying boxes in front of their chests, balls on which indefinable beings sit and ride through the air, staves from which rays are shot out, as if from a sun, strange shapes resembling giant insects, which were vehicles of some sort. There are no limits to the fantasy of the illustrations that result from the visit of our spaceship. We shall see later what traces the gods who visited the Earth in our remote antiquity engraved on the tablets of the past. It is quite easy to sketch the subsequent development of the planet that our spaceship visited. The inhabitants have learned a lot by watching the gods surreptitiously. The place on which the spaceship stood will be declared holy ground, a place of pilgrimage where the heroic deeds of the gods will be praised in song. Pyramids and temples will be built on it, in accordance with astronomic laws, of course. The population increases, wars devastate the place of the gods, and then come generations who rediscover and excavate the holy places and try to interpret the signs. This is the stage we have reached. Now that we have landed men on the moon, we can open our minds to space travel. We know the effect the sudden arrival of a large ocean-going sailing vessel had on primitive people in, for example, the South Sea Islands. We know the devastating effect a man like Cortez from another civilization had on South America. So then we can appreciate, if only dimly, the fantastic impact the arrival of spacecraft would have made in prehistoric times. We must now take another look at the forest of question marks, the array of unexplained mysteries. Do they make sense as the remains of prehistoric space travelers? Do they lead us into our past and yet link up with our plans for the future? Chapter 3. The Improbable World of the Unexplained. Our historical past is pieced together from indirect knowledge, excavations, old texts, cave drawings, legends, and so forth, were used to construct a working hypothesis. From all this material, an impressive and interesting mosaic was made, but it was the product of a